From Capital Public Radio, this is An Ounce of Prevention. I'm Pamela Wu. More than 250 years ago, Benjamin Franklin coined the phrase, "An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure." It means that if a problem could be prevented in the first place, it would save a great deal more time, effort, and expense than trying to repair the damage later. Today, we recognize that it's better to prevent disease than to treat it. Some prevention programs aim to keep people healthy so they'll be more resilient and need less medical care. Other prevention efforts strive to improve overall community health. By some estimates, every dollar spent on prevention today could yield savings of more than $5 in future health care costs. Take hospital emergency room care. Evidence shows that a small number of frequent visitors are responsible for a disproportionate share of the costs. Comprehensive healthcare reform may eventually solve this problem. But until then, a handful of California hospitals have created community outreach programs to reduce costs. Uninsured and underinsured patients are directed out of emergency rooms and into the medical and social services they really need. To find out how this works, Capital Public Radio's healthcare reporter Pauline Bartolone went to rural Tulare County and rode along with a community health worker.
Wendy Martinez deals with health crises all day long. Sometimes the same crisis over and over again.
How are you?
She and a coworker are at Cahuilla Delta Hospital today, meeting with a client who's just been readmitted. We'll call him Julio.
I was in so much pain. For 2 days I stayed there, and I called 911 for them to pick me up.
Julio is in his late 40s, but he looks like an old man. He's here today with an antibiotic-resistant blood infection. He says he's in pain. Wendy and her coworker have been helping him with another problem. His liver is failing, and he's waiting for a transplant.
Yeah, you're not losing hope, though, right?
No.
Okay, yeah. Just things take time. Don't give up on us.
Wendy is with a program called The Bridge at the hospital in Visalia. Their job is to connect frequent ER users with services and care that will keep them healthy and out of the hospital. Wendy's been trying to keep Julio on track for his liver transplant. But during Wendy's visit today, a nurse says Julio's use of painkillers might put him at risk of being rejected for a new liver. So Wendy gives Julio a reality check.
If you abuse your medication, you run out of your medication ahead of time, you go into the doctor and you want more medication ahead of time, what does that behavior sound like?
Okay, I understand you.
No, I'm just...
Well,
I'm
I was
just,
sick. I want to be at home.
Whose side am I on? I'm on your side. I'm only telling you this because I want this transplant to happen for you. That's the way I am. I keep it real, right? Have I not kept it real with you the whole way through?
Right there. Wendy is not a doctor, a registered nurse, or even a caseworker. Her job title is outreach specialist. She works with Cahuilla Delta Hospital's most frequent ER users. Last year, there were about 1,600 patients who checked into the emergency room at least 5 times. That qualified them to get life coaching from Wendy and others at the Bridge.
I feel like I'm at my best when I'm helping others. You know, I just feel like I'm the vessel that God works through to help others. So that's why I keep doing it.
Wendy doesn't do it alone. She often teams with another Bridge worker. It's not easy to help these high-needs clients. Many of them are homeless, drug users, have a mental illness, or a chronic disease. These are the patients other hospital workers say they can't help anymore. So Wendy meets them where they are, outside hospital walls, in homeless shelters, on the street, or in their homes.
We're preventing them from getting stuck in that same cycle of ending up in the hospital with no education, no resources. In the process that we're advocating with them, we teach them to advocate for themselves.
Several times a day, Wendy sees clients surviving a surprising range of difficult conditions. On the same afternoon she saw Julio, she visits a woman in her late 40s who overdosed on methamphetamines and then had a stroke.
She'll probably be restrained because of her brain injury. At times it looks like she's connecting, you know, and then she'll fade out.
Her client, whom we'll call Doreen, is now severely disabled. Her speech is a mumble.
Hi. How are you doing?
Hello.
Yeah. She can't eat by herself, and she's incontinent. When Wendy talks to her, Dorian's dark brown eyes wander.
Tell me again. I can't understand you. I'm sorry. I'm trying.
Dorian lies on the bed, emaciated. Her wrists and ankles are tied so she can't wander off. She needs round-the-clock care. She's been in and out of the hospital repeatedly for months, this time wearing a soiled diaper when she was dropped off by a friend.
Was she feeding you? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And changing you? She got you clean? Yeah? Okay. You know, that's my job. I want to make sure that you're okay. And we're going to try and find a place for you to go next. Okay? A place where you can live.
Wendy's trying to help Dorian qualify for Medi-Cal so she can move into a nursing home with full-time care. That will take a few months. For now, she stays in the hospital. Meantime, Wendy gets through days like this with patience and a little bit of humor.
Did you have a good lunch? No, I can't. I got that part. That's what they say about hospital food, huh?
Wendy spends a lot of time in her car, driving around Tulare County to see her many clients. She talks about how she deals with the amount of suffering and emotion she sees day after day.
Well, I don't turn to drugs and alcohol, so I have to have faith that things are going to work out as they're meant to be. As long as I know I give my best and put my, you know, my effort to the best of my ability, I'm able to go home and sleep at night.
You don't need a college degree to get this job. Wendy says the most important qualification is compassion, and not everyone has it.
You have to be patient. You have to be understanding. I think you have to believe that there is good in everyone. You know, you just have to find that good.
Good health and quality of life are not easy for her clients to grasp.
A lot of the people we work with have no hope, they have no faith, and they don't have anyone that believes in them. So when you can discover that little bit in a person, I think it gives them the hope.
In Tulare County, about a quarter of the population lives in poverty. Almost a third of adults are obese. Wendy helps people who are illiterate, who can't afford the $5 copay to see a doctor. But she doesn't spend a lot of energy on clients who don't comply with the care they're getting.
You know, and that's, we've used that line several times, is that, you know, I can't help you more than you want to help yourself. When you're ready to help yourself, then I'd be more than willing to help you, you know.
But Wendy has also been known to help people who can't or won't improve their health. She checks her phone messages while riding in her car. It's the mother of a 42-year-old diabetic man who stopped eating in a bout of depression. She's calling Wendy in desperation.
This man basically wants to die. He's killing himself. He's not compliant with his medications. He will not be compliant with doctor visits. He's a mess.
We'll call this client Eduardo. He has uncontrolled diabetes. He's refused care repeatedly. Wendy referred him to a diabetes outreach specialist at the hospital, and she's not sure what more she can do.
Well, we need to tell the hospital what it is.
When Wendy and an outreach worker visit him in his home the next day, they find Eduardo in bed, underneath a blanket, where he's been lying for days. His heart is racing and his speech is slurred.
When's the last time you ate? Do you remember the last time you ate?
No.
No? Okay.
Last week?
What did you eat last week?
I don't know.
The diabetes outreach worker helps Eduardo take his blood sugar. His sugar levels indicate a diabetic emergency. He's cold, cranky, and confused, but he does agree to be taken to the hospital. So Wendy, whose job it is to keep people out of the ER, does something unusual. She tells Eduardo's mother to call 911.
Go ahead and call the ambulance.
In the 5 minutes before they hear the approaching siren, Wendy and her coworker give Eduardo a pep talk.
I might as well get some sleep before they go to sleep.
No, you're not going to do that, remember? you're going to go to the hospital. I'm going to start working on getting better. Okay, that's the plan, right?
No, I hate to get poked on all the time.
I know. But you know what? If you continue like this, then you'll get poked all the time. And that's what you don't want.
Yeah, asking me questions over and over.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been doing the same thing over and over. I'm tired of it already.
I know you are.
I know how to get there, or just don't go.
Eduardo's mother is in tears. She paces in and out of the room.
I'm too old, and you mother, I need you. I need you be okay to help me out. I can't do this by myself. I need you help for me and for you and your kids. You know, help me every night, rub your hand, your feet, see how you're suffering. If you love me, do this for us.
When the ambulance workers arrive, they turn out to be the same ones he's refused before. They talk to him like they know him well, and he jokes around with them.
Are you taking your insulin, bud?
I had a party last night. I didn't take my insulin.
You had a party last night, so you didn't take your insulin?
Yeah.
You know better than that, man.
No matter how big you are.
Hold on a second. Stay right there for a second.
Eduardo stumbles backward as he's being assisted to the ambulance. The bridge workers console Eduardo's mom as the ambulance pulls away.
I know that you're hurting, and
you got to take care of you too, okay? For him.
This is a difficult, difficult population that they're working with on a daily basis.
John Tyndall manages the bridge at Kaweah Delta. The program connects clients to services like public health insurance and Social Security income. The California Department of Healthcare Services says increasing enrollment to Medi-Cal could result in higher costs of care.
With our program, if you look at the reduction in costs over the years, we're actually saving taxpayers' money by providing these types of services.
Numerous studies show the cost-effectiveness of intense case management for frequent ER users. One study showed a 50% reduction in emergency room visits among bridge clients a year after they started. That's good for the hospital's bottom line, and it brings down the ER cost to Medi-Cal, too. But Tyndall says it's not just about the money. It's about quality of care.
We've worked with many individuals that we've connected them to various resources throughout the community, and it's really been a turning point in their life. We have a couple patients who, when we started working with them, they hadn't graduated high school, but we got them connected to drug rehab, got them connected to a primary care provider.
A few weeks later, Wendy gave a phone update about her clients. Eduardo stayed in the hospital for 3 days. Wendy says he's still bedridden at his house, but he's eating and getting dental care. Wendy got him a TV and a stuffed bear.
And then when I went to go see him at his house after he was discharged, he had the little bear right in front of him on his nightstand. And he told me, he says, you know, I don't know about this bear. He says, this bear just keeps looking at me and telling me I got to do what I'm supposed to do.
He's still giving his mom a hard time, but Wendy's not ready to give up on him.
My gut says, continue working with him. You know, he can come out of this.
Doreen is on her way to a nursing facility. Julio continues to wait for his liver transplant. They're both still in the hospital. Their stories may not have happy endings, but Wendy Martinez is helping them stay out of the emergency room for now.
That's Capital Public Radio healthcare reporter Pauline Bartolone in Visalia. You can read her behind-the-scenes account of this story in her reporter's notebook at capradio.org/ounce of prevention. This is An Ounce of Prevention from Capital Public Radio. The Center for the Study and Prevention of Violence reports that youth between the ages of 10 and 24 are 3 times more likely than adults to be victims of violence. Nearly a dozen hospitals around the country are taking unusual steps to intervene in the lives of young people injured in gang-related and violent crime. A trauma center in an area of Sacramento troubled by crime has adopted this model. Capital Public Radio's Steve Milne reports on a life-changing trip to the emergency room.
DeAndre Williams is a high school rapper in South Sacramento.
I was stabbed in my side, and I was stabbed in my left eye.
Anyone who gets shot or stabbed in South Sacramento ends up here in the ER.
I'm Maya Leggett. I'm a trauma surgeon at South Sacramento Kaiser. It's relatively quiet right now, and there's no trauma either. I mean, it's Friday, and it's gorgeous out, so I'm sure it's... you might be due.
Leggett is in her mid-30s, but looks younger. She's wearing a white doctor's jacket with her dark hair pulled back. On calmer days like this...
you wait. You know, then there's times where you're thinking it's... quiet and it's raining out and who knew that there was going to be a gunshot coming in, you know, I mean, so it hits you at all times.
People with life-threatening injuries are transported to this level 2 trauma center. Their first stop is the ER's resuscitation room.
This is our resus. This is kind of where we get the patients. They come off of the ambulance over there and kind of roll in here, and then this is kind of where we see them. Some are worse than others. I mean, it all comes down to blood pressure and bleeding and airway. And so if, you know, I'd like to say it's not mayhem, it's controlled chaos, but you urgently are trying to get them to the next step, whether that be the operating room or whatever it may be, you know, to take care of them.
Last year, this resuscitation room provided emergency treatment for 130 people with gunshot or stab wounds. Half of them were between the ages of 15 and 24. According to Kaiser Permanente Trauma Services, 35 of those young patients had gunshot wounds, 28 of them had stab wounds.
Our hospital is actually in one of the hotspots. There's probably three areas that statistically just have shown to have more violent crime and more gang-related crime, things like that. North Highlands, Oak Park, and then the MAC corridor, which is right where we are. Sadly, most of the, we call them penetrating traumas, so either stab wounds, gunshot wounds, most of those victims are the 16 to young 20-year-olds.
Oh, I was stabbed in my left eye, leaving me legally blind. I can't see out of it no more. And I got like 18 stitches down from my chest to my pelvis. I got like 8 more over here on the side, going the other way.
The stabbing happened in South Sacramento on a Thursday night last October.
My name is LeAndre Williams, but in the music world, I go by Young Dre. You know, rapping's always been one of my dreams.
Williams was stabbed just before his 18th birthday. He wears his hair in long cornrows, sports a sparse goatee, and wears a black patch where his left eye used to be.
I wasn't really a bad kid. I wasn't causing problems. I wasn't into gang banging. It wasn't a gang-related incident, you know.
Williams is vague on details about why he was stabbed.
Anybody can get hurt, you know, just walking down the street. You know, it can happen to anybody.
How did you end up in the hospital?
I ended up in the hospital because I was doing something wrong. And I knew it was wrong. Like, I knew it wasn't right, but I was still doing it. I have made some bad decisions.
Williams says he doesn't remember the pain of being stabbed. That came later.
At the time, you know, I didn't really feel nothing. It kind of went numb. Recovery hurt more than actually getting stabbed, you know. Recovery was worse. Because when I got stabbed, left a lot of scar tissue, and then that caused me to having a small bowel obstruction where all my intestines were all like twisted up and stuff. So yeah, that was more painful than getting stabbed.
And in those moments of pain, while they're still recovering in their hospital beds, Dr. Maya Leggett says that's when the Sacramento Violence Intervention Program, or SVIP, steps in.
The reason we try to get them the earlier the better is it's capturing that moment of vulnerability. It's having that life flash before your eyes kind of thing and trying to capture that as far as I really have to make a life change. And the earlier you tend to get them, the better, both for family and for the actual victim.
My name is D'Angelo Mack, and I'm an intervention specialist for the Sacramento Violence Intervention Program. What happens is we get a phone call from the emergency room or the operating room, and we come down and do a bedside. It's a teachable moment, definitely. When a person is shot or stabbed, we find that at that moment they're much more reachable than, you know, if it was maybe a graze or a bloody nose.
Although he was still groggy at the time, LeAndre Williams says SVIP sounded good.
I just seen people that were trying to help me, you know, reaching out for me, and I just took the help because I wasn't going to turn down nobody that was trying to help me. D'Angelo's been the one that I've been connecting with the most.
D'Angelo Mack works for a social service agency in Sacramento called The Effort, which teamed with Kaiser to create SVIP.
In 2010, some statistics showed that the Center Parkway and Macro Corridor was the number one location for homicides in Sacramento. So the city decided that something needed to be done, and Kaiser, being in the community and building their new trauma center, decided something needed to be done. And so they decided to plant it here.
Mack and another intervention specialist counsel a total of 36 clients, nearly all of them young men. Mack and his colleague promote positive alternatives to violence and coordinate services for youth and their families by providing information, referrals, and intensive follow-up services for up to 1 year. When Mack arrives at the ER to meet a prospective client, the first thing he talks to them about is their injury, how it happened.
And then we start talking about change. You found yourself in this predicament. What can we do to change that for the next time? What can we do to keep you safe? What can we do to get you out of a lifestyle that you're not, you know, you don't want to be a part of?
Crazy and corrupt. I'm talking about this world that we live in. The devil trying to talk to me, but I won't give in. Sometimes I'll be lost with no direction. Other times I'm feeling bold without protection.
I've been rapping all my life. This is something I've been doing.
18-year-old stabbing victim, Leandre Williams.
Me and my brothers make songs all the time. Post them on Facebook, hoping the right person hears it. There's one called Cold World. We got a actual video to that one.
It's a cold world that we live in. We gon' flip the day on your toes. It's a good back, yo, chill.
I've been writing a lot since I've got out, and I've been writing about the incident and how it affected my life and how I'm gonna use it to make my life better and be successful. This is very confidential. I'm about to spit you something that I've been writing. Lord, forgive me for the sins I committed. But you know nobody's perfect in this world that we live in. And my guard's up, almost lost my life once, already scarred up. So now I'm being twice as cautious, gassing, getting so exhausted. Enemies trying to put me in a coffin, cause they see what I'm becoming, you don't see that often.
Intervention specialist D'Angelo Mack says much of the violence that happens is rooted in misunderstandings.
I think the generation now has a very difficult time communicating with each other. What we're finding is that they're not all gang related, and most of them are just kids getting into trouble, being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Steering clients closer to the right place includes field trips to art museums, even driving through less threatening neighborhoods to show them what's possible and that there's another world out there. Mack says keeping his clients away from violence and giving them a sense of hope has wider implications for the whole community.
Most of our young people have not even been out of their neighborhoods. We've taken kids to places like San Francisco, and they've been blown away because they've never been out of Sacramento. The clients of ours, they are the community, and so the community in a whole would want to invest in something like this, because what we're doing is transforming the minds of these participants so that we can get them back in the community so that they can start making some positive changes.
Mack meets with clients individually and in group sessions at least once a week. He defines success as seeing victims of violence get healthy, graduate from high school or college, work in some capacity, and live in relatively safe neighborhoods. But there's still the random violence.
Some of the violence I'm seeing, it continues to get younger and younger, and it doesn't matter if you're a part of a certain gang or from a certain side of town. You could be a regular person walking down the street, and violence can find you. That bothers me.
Mack works with young men who want to change their lives, but they still have to go home to neighborhoods where violence is a daily reality. He says SVIP offers these young people a way out of trouble. It's okay, Mack says, if clients are faced with challenges, as long as they have someone to show them a way out.
Having some other place to go or some other person to turn to gives them a choice. Our program offers choice. We're a program that walks into a hospital room and says, hey, we want to help you any way we can. We know we're strangers. I don't know you. You don't know me. But what can I do to help?
Accepting that help has put Leandre Williams on the right path to stay out of trouble.
I got stabbed, yeah, but I'm not going to let that stop me. I'm focusing on getting my schoolwork done so I can graduate high school. get my diploma and start going to college.
William still needs to get a glass eye, and he occasionally goes back to the hospital for follow-up appointments. Dr. Maya Leggett has been keeping track of his recovery.
We've been able to see him a couple times in clinic here. He's a good kid. He's working hard on a lot of stuff. My job is depressing at some points. Not everybody makes it. Even if they do make it, it's not always with the best outcome.
Leggett says she has personal reasons for being a part of SVIP. Her two kids.
They're young still. I'm still shielding them. But that can't happen forever. So you do this job for community reasons, but you do them for personal reasons too. I want to make it better for my kids. It's true that, you know, South Sacramento might have a bad name, but it's not isolated. It's not just the MAC corridor. On some level, it ends up being everybody's problem, because whether you're talking about a financial problem, whether you're talking about, you know, who your kids are, you know, exposed to, all of those things, I think, matter to the entire city, not just the people here in South Sacramento.
As for Leandre Williams, he is on track to get his high school diploma in May and plans to begin his undergraduate work at a community college this fall.
Capital Public Radio's Steve Milne reporting on the Sacramento Violence Intervention Program. It's modeled after a hospital-based program in Oakland called Caught in the Crossfire. Similar programs are operating at San Francisco General Hospital and the UC Davis Medical Center in Sacramento. You can see a video profile of a young woman who's turning her life around with the help of SVIP at capradio.org/ounceofprevention. This is An Ounce of Prevention from Capital Public Radio. This is An Ounce of Prevention. I'm Pamela Wu. Coming up, we'll meet doctors working across the California-Mexico border to provide low-cost medicines and high-tech solutions to help cure tuberculosis. But first, we head north, almost to the Oregon border. In the foothills of Shasta County, a homegrown health center offers help to residents dealing with the isolation of living in this remote region. For nearly three decades, providers here have tended to the injuries and illnesses of their patients. Their focus on building relationships helps weave together the fabric of the community. Capital Public Radio healthcare reporter Pauline Bartolone traveled to Round Mountain, population 155.
Driving north along Highway 299, you notice a few homes tucked in among the evergreen trees on the hills.
There's lots of water, beautiful waterfalls. Most people live on dirt roads. Some people live very remotely.
Lynn Duro moved to rural Shasta County 30 years ago. She's now director of Hill Country Clinic, which helps people with life-altering problems, unemployment, obesity, mental illness, and unstable housing.
It's like a fabric that has a lot of holes in it. And if somebody lives in one of those holes, they can be extraordinarily isolated. I mean, kind of isolated beyond what you could even imagine. So being healthy takes a higher degree of self-awareness here than it might an environment that had more resources in it.
In the mid-80s, Duro and a few friends wanted to create what they thought of as a healing place for area residents. So they started the clinic.
So I always start here because we opened the clinic in 1985.
Duro says the health clinic started small. It burnt down and they rebuilt it. Now it's one of the most modern-looking and busiest buildings on this 50-mile stretch of Highway 299. It serves people from as far away as Reading and remote areas of eastern Shasta County. The quality of the facility in a largely undeveloped area puzzled one out-of-town official.
He was having a real problem with how pretty the building was. Said, why would you want to do this kind of a building for poor people? He actually said that. And we said, well, because we're all in this together. And them is us and us is them here. That's the way it is at Hill Country.
The clinic has grown into Hill Country Health and Wellness Center. It has a commercial kitchen, which hosts cooking classes and a lunch cafeteria during the week. There's a library, a special event room, and a walking trail, even a community radio station and karate classes.
The focus really has been from the beginning on a much more comprehensive approach to healthcare that includes things like jobs and access to education and transportation and healthy beginnings for children.
Duro says living in an isolated area can pose psychological challenges. The suicide rate is twice the state average, and the death rate from drug use is among the highest in California. Hill Country provides social activities in the tiny town of Burney for people with mental illness. The program is called Circle of Friends.
Today's Little Reno Day. We're all just playing poker and blackjack and dice and keno, and it's kind of fun.
Corinne Sherbundi has struggled with mental illness. She was treated at Hill Country, and now she works at Circle of Friends.
You can walk in, and you don't have to be anything other than what you are. You don't have to put on a face that you're well today. You don't have to pretend you're normal. You know, you can just be yourself, be who you are, and you're accepted for exactly that.
Today, at least 20 people are spread around a few tables playing games. A few keep to themselves, but mostly, there's a lot of laughter.
Coming here helps socializing with everybody.
Patricia lives alone. She has a bipolar disorder, and she says coming here twice a week has helped her.
So I haven't been depressed for over a year, and it keeps me out of any mental health hospitals, and it keeps me independent and keeps me out of my home sometimes. Can't stay in your home all the time. And it keeps me happy. I found happiness here.
Before Lindura was director of Hill Country, she was a therapist at the clinic. That's when she realized the importance of providing for the social needs of mental health patients, as well as their medical conditions.
Our medical providers were seeing the same people over and over and over again, not because they had an urgent medical need that only a doctor or a nurse practitioner could fix, but because that patient really wanted to come in because that medical provider was the only social supportive contact that they had in their lives.
Duro says Circle of Friends serves 150 people at a relatively low cost and has taken the place of unnecessary medical visits.
It has absolutely saved people's lives. It's prevented suicide. It's begun the creation of a network that isn't just this center with that telephone number, but it's people having each other's telephone numbers, people who might have otherwise been utterly isolated.
More than half of Hill Country's patients live in poverty. And for teens, the combination of remote location and lack of resources translates into few activities and few opportunities. So Hill Country created a teen center. Natalie Jacobs helps run it. She says the goal is to show these young people that more is possible for them.
The hope is to build a healthier kid, to enable them to go to college, talk about grants and scholarships, and give them that option. Because a lot of them are like, college is like, there's no way. Nobody talks college language at home. For some of them, nobody talks a job, you know, that would be legitimate as far as like paying taxes.
Jacob says the majority of kids have a 40-minute bus ride to school. When it comes to after-school clubs and sports, transportation is an obstacle. The teen center gives them a place to do homework, get a snack, and be with friends.
That safe place creates good roots. It's like a good crowd to hang out with. So that in itself, I think, prevents addictions, prevents depression, just sparks a lot of interest that might never have been there.
A youth advisory board meets here once a month to help teens develop leadership skills and become more employable.
You guys are going to talk about what your service activities are. Painting a gate. You're going to talk to...
See's candy. Don't forget the see's candy.
And you're also going to talk to...
The youth board organizes community service, fundraisers, and social events. Ashley Shabundi comes here often. She was hired to work at the clinic's medical records office.
Being able to be on a board and have what I'm saying count towards something really gave me a lot more confidence in high school and throughout my life, and that's what the teen center is about. It's just opportunity.
Other teens from the center now work at Hill Country, but attendance in the teen program fluctuates and it will soon lose funding. Hill Country director Lynn Duro says the economic crisis of recent years has forced the clinic to be smarter about financial sustainability. They measure success by the health of their patients.
We know that our diabetic patients are in better shape than the state of California in general, and in quite a bit better shape than the nation. Our patients with serious mental illness are in extraordinarily better shape cardiovascularly than the typical patient in California or in the nation. 100% of our patients with asthma are in control.
Duro says Hill Country's success is partly the result of its remote location. They're the only clinic around for miles, and in such remote areas, a little money goes a long way. But she says even in a small town, it's not so easy to get people to take charge of their health.
Don't get me wrong, it's not like we live in a little utopia here or that all of our patients are taking the challenge up and changing their lives. But more and more are, and it's a thing that builds momentum, so the more success that people see around them, the more they think that maybe they could take that on as well.
Okay, take care.
Oh, she just opened.
She's going.
Yeah. Duro says relationship building is at the heart of the wellness center, and she hopes those connections will help keep the community healthy in years to come.
Nice to see you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye,
Neil.
Nice to see you.
Yeah, nice meeting you.
Pauline Bartolone reporting on one of 275 rural healthcare clinics in California. For nearly 5 million people, these are the closest medical facilities that offer primary care and behavioral health services. You're listening to An Ounce of Prevention from Capital Public Radio. There's lots more online from this program at capradio.org/ounceofprevention. The San Ysidro border crossing between Tijuana and San Diego is the world's busiest. Most mornings, the line of cars and pedestrians stretches as far as the eye can see. U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents ask everyone headed into the U.S. if they're bringing anything with them from Mexico.
Is your citizenship?
U.S.
Where do you live?
In Palo.
What are you doing in Mexico today, sir?
I was at the bar all night.
You bring anything back?
Many cars get x-rayed to see if drugs or people are hidden inside, but it's impossible to screen for one potentially lethal stowaway, and often people don't even know they carry it with them. It's tuberculosis. Amy Isaacson reports on recent innovations to help cure this deadly disease, a state-of-the-art clinic in Tijuana, and smartphone technology developed in San Diego are the newest tools used by doctors in a cross-border collaboration. Dr. Rafael Laniato is just getting to work at his tuberculosis clinic at the General Hospital in Tijuana. The city has the highest tuberculosis rate in Mexico.
Just to give you an idea, the rate in the country is around 14 cases per 100,000. In Baja, it's around 40 cases. And in Tijuana, it goes from 50 to 60 cases.
North of the border, the U.S. national TB rate is at an all-time low, just 3.6 cases per 100,000. But San Diego's rate is more than double that, and together, Tijuana and San Diego have the highest concentration of TB of any cities along the U.S.-Mexico border.
We know the bug will not stop in the frontier, so we are trying to approach this problem as a regional problem. not like Mexico and U.S.
Maniato has been working hand in hand with his counterparts on both sides of the border to push for more healthcare workers, better testing, and cheaper medicine to help stop the spread of TB.
Fortunately, my colleagues from the U.S., the physicians, and health personnel in general, we're a very tight community. We suffer along and we understand each other.
Last spring, Baja California's state government built a $700,000 state-of-the-art tuberculosis clinic to treat drug-resistant TB. Maniato is the lead doctor. Drug-resistant TB accounts for just a small percentage of the more than 1,000 new cases of TB every year in Baja. But it's a worry because diagnosing drug-resistant TB requires costly specialized equipment. Treating it is more expensive and takes twice as long.
So this is the reception where we receive the patients and they wait before they go into consultation.
TB is a highly infectious airborne disease, so the new clinic has installed a sophisticated air filtration system that sucks up potentially contagious TB bacteria and zaps them with UV light. Every employee in the clinic wears a face mask, except Dr. Laniato.
I was born in Krypton, so I'm tuberculosis. I never used it. Also, the main reason, I think the patients liked it. I'm not as scared of them.
Not everyone who's infected with TB gets sick. It can lay dormant for a lifetime. But left untreated, the disease can destroy the inside of the lungs until patients can no longer breathe. A 23-year-old patient comes into Laniato's examination room and sits down.
¿Cómo estás, Luis Fernando?
The patient strips off his black hoodie sweatshirt at Laniato's request. He's lost weight since he got sick. He looks very thin.
This lung is extremely destroyed. I always make little drawings.
Laniato flips through the patient's file to find the pair of lungs he's sketched. The left one is scribbled out.
Respira hondo.
Laniato places a stethoscope on the patient's back and listens to him breathe.
Otra vez.
Another doctor has already treated the patient twice for TB in the last 3 years, but he's still sick.
Okay, ponte tu ropa.
A few months ago, the doctor finally sent the young man to Laniato's new clinic.
We had the culture that was resistant to four drugs.
And his prognosis 5 years ago, what would you have said?
He would be dead.
In the last few years, Tijuana has turned into a destination for people in Mexico to be cured of drug-resistant TB. Laniato says a quarter of his patients have moved to the city solely to go to his clinic. In 2009, Baja California gained access to lower-priced drugs through the World Health Organization. A grant from the U.S. Agency for International Development allowed Laniato to send sputum samples to labs in San Diego, where diagnoses could be made more quickly and accurately. And through conference calls with colleagues in San Diego, Laniato has learned how to treat drug-resistant TB more successfully.
We have the highest rate of cure in the country.
Laniato says 90% of drug-resistant patients in Baja California are cured. Worldwide, it's about 50 to 60%.
I guess we'd be average if not we wouldn't work with San Diego. It's vital.
Laniato says his 23-year-old patient will be cured, but he'll have to live with one lung. Another key to the successful treatment of drug-resistant TB is a practice called directly observed therapy, or DOT. The World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control recommend DOT. A promotor or health worker goes to each patient's house to watch the patient take medicine every day, sometimes twice a day. It's an expensive way to guarantee that patients finish their treatment, but Laniato says it's necessary.
Once we start treatment, you might be symptom-free in maybe a month, and you will feel as better as you have felt for the last year. So they feel so good, and they say, I don't need treatment anymore. I don't have any cough, I don't have any fever, I have a lot of appetite. So these pills, I don't want to take them. It's human nature.
If patients discontinue treatment before they're cured, the TB germ can actually become drug resistant. When that happens, treatment can take a year and a half or longer, and sometimes require 20 pills a day. Since 2006, with USAID funding, Promotoris have been assigned to all drug-resistant patients in Tijuana. The money also covers lab testing in San Diego, but it runs out this June.
Not worry about first-line testing. I'm sure we can manage that. I'm not worried about the drugs. We have them. What I'm worried about is promotoras. We need more promotores and supervision.
30 miles north of the border, one of Dr. Laniato's U.S. colleagues is hard at work on a potential solution to Baja California's promotor shortage.
Hi, I'm Richard Garfine, and I'm a professor at the UC San Diego School of Medicine in the Division of Global Public Health.
Richard Garfine's office is on the second floor of a quiet Spanish-style building at UCSD. There's an ocean view, and it feels far from Tijuana. Garfine plans to make a smartphone do some of the Promotoris' work.
Well, this is a HTC phone by Sprint. It's a smartphone, and we use it to implement what we call our video directly observed therapy, or VDOT, intervention.
The idea is to maintain the WHO and CDC standard of care, but to cut down on the resources it takes, especially in a city like Tijuana.
It's a very large city, congested city, so just traveling can be quite difficult. The other thing is that the TB control programs lack the resources to provide a caseworker to observe all the patients. And so without some new mechanism of delivering DOT, it's just not possible.
In San Diego, all TB patients have observed therapy, but it's expensive. One day a few years ago, Garfine was at San Diego County's Office of Public Health. He saw San Diego TB caseworkers using a clunky camera phone system to watch patients take their medicine via two-way video.
Where the patient has a system at their home and the caseworker has a system back at the health department, and every day the caseworker would call up the patient at a designated time, and they would both get on their camera phones, and they would do this interaction by phone, and it worked quite well.
Garfine says a 9-month pilot test of the equipment saved the county 28,000 miles of driving and about 800 hours of staff time.
I thought it was brilliant, but then I thought, couldn't they do this with a mobile phone? We're in the 21st century now. You know, I watch my kids on their smartphones and they're sending videos all over the place. And I thought, well, why couldn't we do this for a practical application?
Garfine thought, forget the clunky camera phone. There should be an app for that. He submitted a grant proposal to the National Institute of Health for a pilot project. It was approved. Garfine, along with San Diego Public Health and Tijuana's TB Control Program, passed out free phones to 43 patients, some in San Diego and some in Tijuana. Like tens of thousands of people in the region, some of the patients cross the border daily to work, visit family, to go to the supermarket or the bank. Directly observed therapy was impossible for them before the smartphone app, because even if the Promotor was available, the patients weren't home.
It's not just making it cheaper and easier, it's actually solving a problem that was not being dealt with before.
Back in Tijuana, one of Dr. Laniato's patients has just dropped off a sputum sample. She's been part of Garfine's smartphone program for 5 months, just 1 month of treatment to go. She's 25 years old in skinny jeans. Her long hair is pulled back into a ponytail. As she leaves Laniato's clinic, she notices that it's just after 11 o'clock. She takes her TB medications every morning at 11.
I'm going to take off my face mask. We're going to take out the pills again.
Instead of racing home to meet her promotor or missing the meeting, the young woman reaches into her little black purse for her phone and pills.
Okay. Otra vez, vamos a preparar el teléfono para grabarnos.
We're going to get the phone ready to record.
Entonces, ya le voy a poner start para empezar a grabar.
Okay, now I'm going to press start to record.
Hola, mi número de participante es 858.
Hi, my participant number is 858.
She holds each pill up to the camera.
Hoy me tomaré dos pastillas de Dosval. Son unas cápsulas color guinda.
Today I'll take two Dorval pills.
Una.
They're maroon-colored capsules.
Then she swallows it with a sip of water.
Dos. Estoy mostrando la segunda cápsula. Sí me ha tocado que estoy aquí en la clínica. Al principio que venía todos los días, personas que se
When I first started, I came to the clinic daily. There were people who came walking from I don't even know where just so they could take their medicine. They battled a lot because they didn't have the resources to come every day.
Les ayudaría mucho.
So I think one of these phones would help a lot.
Across town, one of Tijuana's TB control program promotores has seen firsthand how much the phones help.
Hola, buenas tardes. Mi nombre es Cristian Colín. Soy promotor de salud.
I'm Cristian Colín. I'm a health promoter, and I'm just getting in from the field, from dropping off medicine. I'm here to check the patients who take medicine using the cell phone.
Estoy abriendo la página.
Colleen logs into the page where patients' videos are posted online and clicks on one.
Good afternoon. I'm at my aunt's house and I'm going to take my medicine. It is Saturday, February 11th, and it's 5:30 in the afternoon. Okay, here we go. One.
Colleen can see 8 patients in person every day. It takes him 5 hours. In 1 hour, he can check 8 patients on video. He likes the convenience, but misses seeing his patients in person.
I like the contact with them, arriving, saying hi, seeing that they're doing well. It's like a friendship with the patients.
Colleen may miss the personal touch, but the technology gives patients the freedom to carry on with their daily lives. As for UC San Diego's Dr. Richard Garfin, he plans to apply for more funding for a larger test of the smartphone app.
The idea would be to make a system like this available that it could be used by health departments anywhere in the world.
Regardless of where you live, patients have the right to receive the best treatment available.
Dr. Rafael Laniato says it's this kind of cross-border ingenuity that helps cure the worst cases of TB. But he and his colleagues need to find more funding to continue their high standard of care. For Capital Public Radio, I'm Amy Isaacson in San Diego.
Whether it's an international collaboration like this one, a regional clinic serving an isolated population, a one-on-one program steering youth away from violence, or an advocate finding alternatives to the ER, these are healthcare heroes, each following a different path toward the same goal of healthier communities. You can find Amy Isaacson's reporter's notebook at capradio.org/ounceofprevention. There's also a video by Andrew Nixon, who followed the northward journey of those sputum samples from Dr. Laniato's clinic in Tijuana to a lab at UC San Diego. It's all online, including audio, video, and slideshows from all of the stories in this program. An Ounce of Prevention was reported by Pauline Bartolone, Steve Milne, and Amy Isaacson. Produced by Catherine Stifter, Paul Conley, and Alan Ray. Multimedia and web content was created by Andrew Nixon and Veronica Nagy. Music composed and performed by Scott Collard. The executive producer was Joe Barr. Funding for this program was provided by the California Endowment and the California Healthcare Foundation. There's much more online at capradio.org/ounceofprevention. I'm Pamela Wu. This program was produced by Capital Public Radio in Sacramento.